Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, finally today, we want to end with sharks, because it is shark season on the Cape. The great whites usually start arriving around Memorial Day and leave with the fall season in September. But as you head out to the beach this summer, let's debunk some of the myths surrounding one of the ocean's most mysterious creatures, starting with their perceived danger to humans.
We really only have about 4 documented shark attacks in Massachusetts going back literally hundreds of years. So if we were to take that as an indication of risk or probability of attack, we really can see that it is quite low.
Well, that's Greg Skomal, senior marine fisheries biologist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. In fact, the danger of shark attack is so low, compare those 4 attacks to the 43,000 people who are injured in 1 year by the dreaded toilet. I'm serious. The potty is more dangerous a predator to human beings than the shark. Well, the realities behind those numbers is the subject of a new children's book, The Great White Shark Scientist. And joining us now is the book's author, Cy Montgomery. She's the author of 20 books, including the 2015 National Book Award finalist, The Soul of an Octopus. And she's in Concord, New Hampshire today. Cy Montgomery, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
You know, we didn't really want to play the Jaws music because it reinforces so many terrible stereotypes about sharks, but that was the one way we could get it in, Jaws vis-a-vis how awful the toilets are for human beings. But but first of all, I mean, the book is an absolute delight. Can you tell us, I mean, you've written about so many other creatures. Why were you interested in following a great white scientist?
Well, I've known Greg for about 30 years, actually. In the 80s, I went out with him on his boat looking for blue sharks to tag. And even though I was seasick, he still let me pull in a blue shark and tag it. And when I learned that his very favorite shark of all time had started showing up off of New England's most iconic beach, I felt like, this is going to be a great book. I could not wait to get on the boat with Greg again and follow these beautiful giant predators around.
Right, as he goes out to both by sea and by air, and the book, oh my gosh, the air picture, the airborne pictures of sharks in the water off the Cape are absolutely gorgeous, I have to say. But he goes out.
Keith Ellenbogen, he's the photographer that did it, and he's a blast to work with.
It's amazing. So Greg goes out and his team go out to both identify, monitor, and tag sharks as well. And your book starts on Tuesday, on a Tuesday, July 8th, on Greg's boat. Can you tell us what happened in the first day that you go out with him?
Well, we actually had been waiting a little bit. The day before, we couldn't go out at all. Because, you know, if you're going to have both a boat and a spotter plane go out, the weather has to be pretty decent. They're hard animals to see. As you know, the Cape's waters are a murky green. Mm-hmm. And if there's chop on the water, it makes it even harder to see them. Glare on the water can make it really hard to see them. So there's this incredible ballet going on between the spotter plane above and Greg's boat below so that Greg can get right over these animals in order to either tag them or use a long pole to stick a GoPro in and film them so he can see who's who. So the first time we went out, we didn't see any sharks. But we did see some cool stuff. We saw the reason the sharks are there, for example, which is seals.
Right.
The gray seal comeback is what's drawing them back. And it was very exciting just to be out on the water with the guy and see all these seals and also see how hard it is to do his job.
Mm. Yeah, well, how hard it is physically and how much patience you have to have sometimes. But then later on subsequent days, you see them and he's able to tag some. He tells what it was like when you get right up, the boat gets right up next to a great white.
Oh, yeah, man, this was an amazing day. The third time we went out, it was August, And usually most of the sharks are actually seen in July, but the year that we did this was 2 years ago. Most of the animals are actually seen in August and September. And he was going out, and every day he could go out, he was seeing shark upon shark. And sometimes we were being told by Wayne, well, there's one over here and there's one over there. Which one do you want? And he'd have to pick which one he was following. And he gets right over these animals. He's been working a lot on this wonderful boat called the Aleutian Dream, which is owned by two wonderful shark enthusiasts who modified the boat with a steel pulpit sticking out like a big nose in front of the boat so that Greg can get real, real close to the animals and stick this long pole in and film them so that he knows who's who. Because each shark has a distinctive pattern where the upper dark part of the animal meets the lower white part of the animal. And this pattern is as distinctive as a human fingerprint or as distinctive as a human face.
Yeah.
So it's only by doing this that you can really estimate how many animals are out there, which was one of the goals of his study.
Right. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but you know, when you were describing, I was just seeing in my mind's eye that pattern between the dark upper and white lower of the shark and how distinctive they are. Because you write in the book how Greg and his team get to know individuals. I mean, they really get to know some of these sharks, including one named Julia, who's one of the first to come back every season.
Yeah, I got to find out. I'm going to see Greg on Sunday, and I got to find out if Julia has been back yet. Mm-hmm. And some of these animals have been tagged with real-time satellite tags, which means that you can follow them day to day on your smartphone.
Yeah.
And so people will know, like, oh, you know, Mary Lee showed up off the shores of Jersey just the other day and she's headed north, or Julia's going to ping in, or Lydia is coming. I mean, he's known these animals for years, and some of them he's met up close and personal, tagging them himself. Others he hasn't actually seen in years, but he's still following their movements. And this is yielding an amazing map of where these animals go. Just breathtaking.
Well, so I'm looking at that map right now of one of the sharks, and it's at this tangle of red lines of everywhere the shark sort of pinged over the past, several months, and it's all over the Atlantic. I mean, that's one of the things that you write about in the book, about how much we're learning about these sharks, that they can swim tens of thousands of miles.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And it's also amazing to see how distinctive each individual is. Because if you look at the shark maps that I'm looking at, which shows Mary Lee, it shows Catherine, she's a 2,300-pounder, and Lydia, who's a 14-footer, their maps are very different. I mean, they do typically leave the Cape in the fall and go south, but some of them go halfway to Europe. Some of them go all the way up to Newfoundland. And what are they doing? This is just such a fascinating thing. And no one really knew anything about the Atlantic population until Greg was the first person to tag an Atlantic white shark.
Yeah. So, I mean, the adventure of being alongside Greg Scomall and taping and tagging and following these sharks is one of the breathtaking things in the book. But the other things that you write about what we're learning about them are equally astounding to me. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're learning from Greg's research that we didn't know before about these great whites?
Well, I learned so many amazing things. I mean, first, I did not know that these fish live as long as we do.
Hmm.
They live 70 years. If we don't kill them.
Right.
I'm also just amazed by, you know, the number of teeth these guys can produce in a lifetime, 30,000 teeth. which explains why you find all these fossilized shark teeth. But even more than that, I guess the thing that impressed me the most was how they are not these curmudgeonly, crabby fish that want to bite you all the time. They're actually quite shy. And that iconic fin that you always imagine as being seen from the beaches and everyone runs away. Most of the time, that is a harmless ocean sunfish, not a great white.
Hmm.
These guys, their fins are very seldom seen above the water. And the reason is that they get sunburned just like we do.
Yeah.
They're actually very shy fish. And this makes Greg's job harder yet, because while some of them are pretty calm and are willing to hang out, a lot of times they get scared of stuff and they swim away real fast.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a page in the middle of the book that I feel underscores why this research and why teaching people about it is so vitally important. And I'm just going to read some of the facts. You have this page, Sharks by the Numbers. So the estimated number of, by the way, they are prehistoric animals. They've been on the earth longer, millions of years, hundreds of millions of years before the dinosaurs even were, or before
right.
the dinosaurs went extinct, I should say. So estimated number of sharks worldwide amongst the 500 species is about 7 billion. Estimated number of humans worldwide, about 7 billion, a little bit more than that now. Now, average number of people killed by sharks of all species yearly, worldwide, about 11. But the number of sharks of all species killed by people every year, 100 million. I mean, we are doing the best we can to decimate these beautiful animals. And it's a heartbreaking truth. So I'm just wondering if that's one of the reasons why you think it's so important to help people understand it's not Jaws.
Right. Exactly. Exactly true. And when you think of, you know, what's going to make you die? Well, the third leading cause of death in the United States is errors that doctors and nurses make in hospitals. But do we want to kill all the doctors and nurses? No, of course not, because they provide an important service, and so do great white sharks. I mean, great white sharks do occasionally make a mistake. They would much rather eat a seal, a nice, blubbery, nutritious seal. I mean, to them, a seal is like a steak with a piece of chocolate cake, and you or me, that would be some stringy piece of celery that's been sitting out on the counter. But occasionally, they will bite a person. They usually spit them out, and people usually survive.
Mm-hmm.
But we need these animals on the earth. If you look at what happens when we get rid of apex predators, a big mess happens.
Yeah.
We get what you call a trophic cascade, and everything down to the quality of the water suffers. So we don't want to get rid of sharks just because very, very rarely a person is hurt. That makes as much sense as draining the ocean because someone drowned.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to wrap up by saying that the Boston Globe called you part Indiana Jones and part Emily Dickinson. It's so true. You bring both adventure and poetry to our understanding of the natural world. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Cy.
Oh, such a treat. Thank you.
Cy Montgomery is the author of The Great White Shark Scientist. She's written 20 books, including the recent 2015 National Book Award finalist, The Soul of an Octopus. And by the way, if you're interested in tracking the sharks we've talked about yourself, you can download the free app Ocean Global Shark Tracker. We've got a link to it at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.